This is Adam Sterling on CFAX 1070.
So a headline the other day said 40% of BC Ferries cancellations were due to crew shortages. Says the number of canceled BC Ferries sailings, post-media reporting, due to staffing shortages more than doubled in the 2023 fiscal year compared with the previous year. Says it comprises 40% of all ferry cancellations, according to the company's latest annual report. 1,163 cancellations due to crew shortages in the fiscal year ending March 31st. That's up from only 500 in 2022, so it more than doubles. The spike, it says here, is even more startling when compared to 2020, when 25 sailings were canceled due to staffing issues, and in 2021 with 109. So here's the trend. 25, 109, 522, 1,163. Now, I know 2020 was a different year because of COVID. So I guess we'd probably want to get some more years than that. I don't see that in front of me here. But still, I think that anybody can spot a trend here. And if crew is the problem in terms of a lack thereof, how can we address that? Well, better working conditions seems to be a reasonable place to start. Here to talk more about the issue is Eric McNeely, president of the BC Ferry and Marine Workers Union. Morning. Thanks for the time.
Morning, Adam. Thanks for the interest.
Help us understand how it's possible that we can have this many cancellations due to crew shortages.
Yeah, so I think there's a number of factors that come in, but, I think one of the big problems that you touched on the opening there is working conditions. You know, you look at BC Ferries, and right now there's about, more than 30% of the workforce is casual, and that means that they're on call with no guarantee of work, and that creates challenges for people. And we did a survey recently where over 51% of respondents said they've taken up secondary income just to supplement the work they're doing at BC Ferries. So, you know, when you're working for an employer that doesn't guarantee you work, that can create a challenge where someone might be taking up secondary work, and that could also impact their availability for shifts at BC Ferries for the more than 1,500 casual members that work there.
Now, have things changed? Is the pay worse than it used to be, or the working conditions worse than they used to be?
So year over year, what my members have seen is their real purchasing power slide against inflation. And certainly in 2020, when we negotiated collective agreement, and in the past, we have taken zeros and low percentage increases. So what it's come down to now is other employers, either in the marine industry or adjacent industries, are more competitive employers as far as rates of pay go. So I've talked to members who are supervisors on terminals, and they're looking at potentially going to Starbucks because they'll make more money there. And that's not something we would have seen maybe 20 or 30 years ago, BC Ferries, when everyone anticipated that it was a good job. Whereas now we have members who, you know, even full-time members, making between $50,000 and $55,000 a year in their annual salary.
So how much money are we talking to close that gap? Surely there's a number.
Well, because we're a full trade service union, there's some substantial differences between positions. So in the trades, you know, upwards of 25% difference between BC Ferries employees and their peers in shipbuilding industry or trades around the province. And then for those skilled ships officers positions, looking between 18 and 40% different between BC Ferries and, say, Washington State or C-SPAN, as an example. And I think something else that hasn't been done in BC Ferries in the last 20 years, probably in a meaningful way, is helping people with their careers and advancing their careers. And one of the problems when you're trailing as on wages is you need to invest in your people, because it's harder to poach people than it is to coach them when you aren't paying near industry rates. And BC Ferries hasn't been investing in their employees to build that depth to ensure that the deckhands become captains and the catering staff have opportunities to move into navigational and engineering departments as well.
I'm racking my brains here. I want to say it's 37 vessels in the fleet all in for BC Ferries, or give or take. It's in that neighborhood. How many employees, how many crew short are we to get back up to where we want to be?
Well, it depends on the vessel. So sometimes when those cancellations happen, it can be, you know, a chief engineer or a captain. So one person could cause a sailing not to go. Hmm. But otherwise, there's times when if you're missing a deckhand or a catering attendant or a couple of catering attendants, that may mean the vessel can no longer go. And I think what we saw in the past is vessels, especially in the summer, would crew to their high levels. So they would have, you know, as much crew as they could to get on the vessel. So that'd be an A license where they can carry the maximum capacity of passengers and travelers. What we've seen as well over the past couple of years is it'd be a reduction of the capacity for the vessel because the crew starting crew complement is lower, and that means that you need less people to call in, or someone has a death in the family, emergency, a car accident, and they're no longer able to get to work that day. You know, if you're running at a C license instead of an A license, missing one or two crew members can have a negative impact on that reliability of the vessel. And I think we're seeing that. I mean, we look back 12, 13 months ago, I think Mark Collins was on the news suggesting that my members were calling in sick, and that was the cause of the sailing disruptions last year.
Mm.
And that would be in the same fiscal period. But I think more accurately, my members are coming in all the time on overtime. The system runs on overtime because there aren't enough full-time staff. So, you know, people burn out. And that's, I think, fundamentally the real challenge. And my members haven't seen any respite. They worked straight through the pandemic in 2020, 21. You know, it was sort of a recovery year. Back in 22, we thought it was going to get better. And here we are more than halfway through 23. And it sort of feels a bit like Groundhog Day.
Nicholas Jimenez, relatively new in the job. Your thoughts? Is he doing a good job?
Well, I think he took on a difficult portfolio coming to BC Ferries. That being said, I did see Joy McPhail and Nicholas Jimenez do a lot of good work at ICBC, so I'm hopeful that they'll make some changes. You know, something that the union's really looked at recently is the level of management to unionize employees, that ratio, and it does seem quite high, and we're hopeful that Nicholas will make changes like he did at ICBC.
Because I'm looking here, it says they've hired 900 employees between January and June this year. That's got to count for something.
Yes. One of the challenges hiring is retention. So even if you hire 900 people within 1 year, retaining them may be a challenge. Mm. And a lot of people coming into BC Ferries aren't in the highly skilled positions. So the trades, the ship's officers, a lot of that will be entry-level positions. And if you're doing that in January, February, March, April, what that means is you may not have the capacity or the depth in your operations to backfill for people who have more experience or different levels of certificates. So, you know, 900 entry-level positions may not correlate with relief into a first engineer or a captain or a mate.
It was recently... Oh, sorry.
Go ahead.
I was actually going to say, any final thoughts for now?
Well, you know, we're coming into a long weekend. You know, just keep in mind that my folks, the ones you see in uniform, they're not setting the prices or the schedule. They're there to make sure the vessels run. And like they did over the beast, a lot of them were ensuring that the vessels could go, including doing double shifts just to make sure that the travelers are able to get back and forth. So the people you see are the ones doing the work. And if you want to reach out to BC Ferries or provide input to the commissioner, ferryfeedback.ca is a good opportunity to provide that information directly.
It was recently reported 40% of BC Ferries cancellations were due to crew shortages. Our guest is Eric McNeely, president, BC Ferry and Marine Workers Union, offering that organization's perspective. Thank you for your time.
Thank you.
Bye now. All right, folks, open line reaction after this, 250-386-1161.
Adam Sterling on CFAX 1070 and streaming on the iHeartRadio app.
Texter at 107010 writes, Adam, you're in the business of making predictions. Do you expect Lillian Spock to resign? I honestly don't know what I expect at this point. I'm sort of shocked that she was as confident and assertive as she was, given what was eventually coming from the ombudsperson office. But then again, I suppose people voted for her. She won, so, you know, no refunds in terms of where voters put their expectations on what that investigation will ultimately bring back. And let's see, another 3 years and 2 months until the next time the people of Langford get to go to the polls. On the other hand, though, it sounds like they're having a tough time at Langford Council because democracy is a conversation that happens every day, not a conversation that happens, or a contest, I should say, that's won every 4 years, although that conversation itself seems to be causing no shortage of controversy in terms of the R. Langford crew and others who are trying to ask basic questions. Where is the mayor? And I mean that. The mayor had a... I thought the mayor was supposed to be at that meet and greet. I don't remember seeing come and meet everybody except the mayor at Friday night at Station Avenue for Langford. Somebody said, where did they advertise that? They do it on Instagram. Langford has a social media presence only on Instagram for some reason. It doesn't have a social media presence, officially speaking, on Facebook or Twitter that I can tell, but they are on Instagram. So if you follow them there on that particular Meta platform, you will see that they did advertise about it. But why wasn't the mayor there? We don't know. Maybe they scheduled a meet and greet for the mayor and council knowing that the mayor wasn't going to be there. That seems somewhat unlikely to me. Mary Wagner, the acting mayor, was giving comments to media at that point on the unfolding Danbrook Park unsheltered situation. So, yeah, I don't know where he is right now, and I'm not sure anybody does. So we don't know when the code of conduct's going to get reconsidered. We don't know when Langford Council is going to receive its conflict of interest training, both of which we were told yesterday by the ombudsperson of British Columbia, Jay Chalk, were conditions to end an investigative process involving the potential of maladministration, as Jay Chalk put it yesterday. The way the ombudsperson works is a complaint is made, the public body is examined by the office. When they reach a point in the investigation where they can deem it is likely or possible that maladministration has taken place, they will approach the public body and say, look, we have reason to believe that maladministration may have taken place here, but good news, we like to settle with people. So if you would like to engage in an agreement with us where you're going to take steps to help address the problem that, as far as we can tell, potentially or even likely happened, we don't need to finish our investigation and actually make findings of fact or wrongdoing. We can just say that there were the potential of wrongdoing that took place, but steps are being taken and things are better now. And as long as you do them, everybody moves on. Those are my words. His words sounded more professional because he's the ombudsperson.
Under the Ombudsperson Act is when we start an investigation, we give notice to the public body, we set out and do our investigation. And at some point, our investigators can come to a preliminary assessment that a public body may have engaged in conduct that, in the words of Section 23 of the Ombudsperson Act, is some type of maladministration. So the Act provides for a number of different things that constitute, not great administrative conduct by a public body.
And not great administrative conduct, and he said that's what happened with Langford. It got to the point where they said, yes, this might have happened. So the process at that point, lets Langford, somebody on my text messages yesterday likened it to a plea deal. And while that certainly would imply criminal conduct that I do not wish to imply in this particular situation, it is essentially a deal that the offending or potentially offending municipality can make with the authority to say, hey, look, we're never going to find out whether or not I really did this. So I get to say there was no finding of wrongdoing. But I'm gonna take these steps over here, and things are gonna be better. And you're gonna watch me do them. And as long as I do those steps, you're gonna stop your investigation, and everybody lives happily ever after.
Like it when public bodies, at the first instance, recognize that things weren't necessarily done right in a particular case, and are willing to make the changes that we've suggested. So, that's what happened in this case, and it's what happens, frankly, in the vast majority of cases.
But he was also clear that they obviously had concerns with the conduct of Councillor Spock.
But what this case pointed out was that we obviously had concerns with respect to the conduct of the councillor involved, but we also have an expectation that staff are responsive to and aware of potential issues of conflict of interest.
Yeah, and that's why they wanted it included, so that staff can file complaints under the code of conduct. Because if there's a situation where, and Langford's code of conduct is actually mentioned in two places in the report, Section 14 and Section 20. That's not in the Black Press story, but it's in the report, I can tell you that. And those two sections have to do with city resources being used in specific ways. And the bottom line is that if you're a councillor, you can't tell the city public works crew to go fix something in front of your son's house. You're not supposed to do that, regardless of what's actually happening. You shouldn't be that directly involved. So if that ever happens in future, without necessarily saying that it happened in the past, what would happen is that city works crew or that manager who gets that request could file a code of conduct complaint saying, our code of conduct says that counselors aren't supposed to be directing operational matters to cause direct benefits to themselves or their family members. And I think that this has been contravened, and that complaint could be filed by a staff member. Right now in Langford, they can't do that. Langford has a code of conduct that says you can't direct staff to personally benefit or language similar to that. But if a counselor does it, there's no mechanism for the staff member to blow the whistle. It has to be a counselor that files the complaint. And those are the only people who can file complaints. So the counselor has to tell on themselves, or you have to have one counselor tell on another counselor to get it addressed. And Jay Chalk, I think like many of us, said, no, that's too narrow. We need to get that bigger.
And so we thought that it was too narrow to prevent staff from being able to raise those concerns.
By the way, I got swarmed for like two straight weeks for saying exactly what the ombudsperson just said on Twitter. And no, I haven't forgotten.
It was too narrow to prevent staff from being able to raise those concerns. And so that was one of the suggestions that we had made.
And the other suggestion had to do with conflict of interest training. So again, like, it's not like the end of the world. But it's also, the complaint was not cleared with, like, how do I say this? It's true that there were no findings of wrongdoing, but there was no finding at all because the process that does the findings was halted because the settlement was reached. You know, the plea deal is something that was, as I mentioned, raised on the text messages yesterday. And while it was not criminal in any sense that I can tell, I think the idea of Langford admitting that something might have happened without saying that it did, and saying, we're going to take these steps to address it, as long as, you know, you can say that it might have happened and we don't have to admit it, everybody's happy, everybody goes home. That's essentially what happened in this case. So when you see all these political boosters elsewhere, no wrongdoing, no wrongdoing, no wrongdoing. Well, I mean, that's the way the situation and the procedure works. It doesn't mean that there was a finding that nothing happened. It means that there was no finding. And the process itself was truncated. And they can't just forget about it either. I asked him yesterday. I asked Jay Chalk, are you going to be monitoring this situation?
You bet. That's something we'll be monitoring.
And that's where we stand right now. So anyway, 250-386-1161. Text her 107010. So do I think that she will resign? I don't know. A lot of people want her to. And I think a lot of people backed her and supported her in the election that expected a very different outcome to this. Frankly, I don't know if it'll be a deal breaker for all of her supporters or anything close to that, but I really do think that there were a number of people who expected nothing to ever come of this. Why? Because I was told by those who supposedly were in the know around this case in February that there was nothing here, it was over, it wasn't going to come to fruition. It was when I looked into it at that point that I realized that wasn't true. The investigative process is, despite what was seemingly common knowledge at that point, that it was nothing that had been dismissed a long time ago. And it may be true that one or more persons made those statements publicly on social media. That wasn't true. The process was slow. It was ongoing, but it had not yet concluded at that point. So I think a lot of people thought the process was done. They thought it was over. They thought it was concluded. And now they're sitting here finding out from me, of all people. And that's going to be difficult for that counselor and any other counselor to explain. So that's on them. One of the things I also asked the ombudsperson yesterday is who would have approved the actual settlement. And he said that, you know, it's they don't actually mandate a specific decision-making mechanism. But I would be shocked if Langford Council didn't know about the ombudsperson finding sometime before July 24th, because that's when the report's dated. Which means that the code of conduct debate that all of us went through for like 3 or 4 weeks with Victoria probably had people in the know, politically speaking, because it's a small town and people talk, even if they're not supposed to, people talk, probably knew that this was coming, that this was going to drop. And they probably had a pretty good idea that I was going to find a way to crowbar it out of City Hall one way or the other, because let's be honest, that's what I do. Which means that they were attacking me not because they thought I was wrong, but because they knew I was right, which I'm not happy about. But then again, I'm not happy about a whole lot of things. Especially you.
Thank you for taking my call.
I'm not taking your call. Don't thank me too quick. Have a nice day, Mehdi. Let's see. Texter 107010 says they think it's totally like a plea deal. Says you only want a deal if you're worried something worse might be found. Well, I mean, like, settlements happen all the time, right? And it's there can be an argument over the exact definition of what happened. There can be an argument over this, over that. But at the end of the day, if you're going to go through some huge process to make a finding when the difference between the two parties isn't that big, I think it can be a useful path forward in limited circumstances. That is not the same as saying nothing happened. The political line I heard over and over and over again from supporters was nothing happened. That is not true. Something happened. What it was might have been reasonably considered as unfair. The process to make that finding never got to the part where it would actually call it one way or the other because it was ended by the settlement. That's my understanding. Quick break. Back after this.
This is Adam Sterling on CFAX 1070.
Generative AI is a term that I didn't know until relatively recently, and I'm sure not many of you knew it either. The idea that you can just tell a computer to create something, whether it's a picture, a work of art, or a body of prose or writing, and just have it generate something from nothing has long been the realm of science fiction. We all remember the holodeck on Star Trek. You just describe a scene and it would generate some random scene without you having to put all the little details into it. We now have the ability to have photographs generated that way as well as pieces of writing generated that way. And theoretically speaking, it can be very difficult to tell with certainty what was generated by artificial intelligence and what wasn't. There are hallmarks you can look for, though. Like in the older versions of the picture AI, look at people's hands. Apparently, the AI would have problems generating people's hands because of the many pictures that it looked at on the internet. Apparently, people's hands aren't always visible, so it would have more difficulty with that. Although the newer versions are getting even better when it comes to that. So if you're an educator, we're not going to talk about photographs, by the way. We're going to talk about writing. If you're an educator and your job is to assess the writing that's provided by, say, you know, 20, 30, 50 or more students, especially if you're up into the post-secondary levels, how can you tell what's AI and what's not? How are educators adapting to this? And how are kids being taught to use these tools to their benefit instead of ways to trick the teacher and be lazy? Among these other items we're going to be discussing today is a professor with the Beattie School of Business, Simon Fraser University, Professor Terry Griffith. Thanks so much for your time, Professor. Good morning.
Good morning, and welcome to this very different fall.
You know, the idea of being able to push a button and have a computer write an essay for me is something that existed in sci-fi when I was a kid. I'm going to be honest, I didn't think we'd ever see it, but here we are. How are educators adapting?
Well, I think there's sort of two categories right now, and there are those of us who spent the entire summer rethinking what it is we need to be teaching this fall. And then there are those who are going to be very surprised when they walk into the classroom and get that first homework assignment back from their students.
So what are you going to be teaching and others going to be teaching this fall?
Well, those who've been, you know, very focused on how things have shifted have to say, I need to teach people how to use it. I need to teach people about the values that they need to, you know, have as a foundation. So what does plagiarism mean? What does giving credit for prior work mean? And then what are we really trying to teach? So did I want someone just to write an essay, or was that essay supposed to be showing me how they understood a set of concepts? And given the AI, now how I want them to show me that set of concepts and how they can use it in their work is a little bit different. And, you know, in my homework assignments, I say, I have a little, you know, FAQ, a frequently asked questions section, and I have in there, you know, can I use AI to do this work? And I say, well, if you don't, it's going to be a lot more difficult than it needs to be.
So the assumption is that everyone will use the tool so the overall difficulty level can increase.
And the quantity. So I used to have an assignment that I thought was great. They were creating these playbooks that they can use in their jobs and their work. I teach mostly professional students. And I could only ask them to do three as a kind of a reasonable requirement. And I doubled that for this term. And I'm really expecting both more quantity, which is good for them. They leave the course with more tools to use in their work. But also, I am going to expect higher quality. If I see, you know, spelling errors, something is very wrong.
Are you going to be using artificial intelligence in your marking and assessment?
I think where I'm going to be using it, and I don't start until a few weeks from now, is in the section where I say to them, this is how you could make this even better. So I think what I'm going to do is I'm going to be providing the same kind of feedback that I would have been providing, but then they're going to get more. They're going to get this piece that maybe I wouldn't have had time. I've got about 47 students in the upcoming course. I wouldn't have had time to give every single student, especially now that I've increased the workload, the kind of background on what could you have done as a next step, but I absolutely can think about how that AI might give us those possibilities. Critical is going to be that I let them know that's how I did it, right? And so the transparency around how we use these tools, I think, is something we need to really be talking to people about.
And it's fascinating how tools like ChatGPT can generate prose that reads as if a human mind produced it. And yet, I've heard the term hallucinate described in terms of both photographs and prose, because sometimes the information in that text will be completely wrong. It will be syntactically correct, but the semantics will be all over the place. So how do we screen for that?
Absolutely. So, you know, a lot of the advice I give is, you know, don't be using it if you don't know enough to know when it's wrong. And when I met with these students a few weeks ago, I said, you know, this is going to be the first course where you have basically had an intern working for you. But just like having a human intern working for you, that intern is not of your skill set. They may be able to do more research. They may be able to reach out to a wider set of resources. But you still have to check the work, and you're still responsible for the work that you turn in. So that's always kind of sitting in the back of my mind, is I have to make sure that I do read every single thing it says when I am using one of these tools, and I have to be in a position to know when it's gone off the rails.
Fascinating. Our guest, Professor Terry Griffith, Beattie School of Business, Simon Fraser University, just one of many educators incorporating the reality of artificial intelligence into modern teaching practices. Instead of rejecting it or banning it, our guest, the professor, encouraging its use, in fact, but adapting the assessment practices on the grading side to incorporate that. Fascinating work being done. Thanks for the time today. Any final thoughts?
I just want to really say, if you're someone who knows how to use these tools, I really think it's an opportunity to speak to your children, your colleagues, your family members. We can't let people lag behind on this one.
All right. Thanks so much for the time. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
All right. Bye now. And apologies, that sound was me. I hit the wrong button. We are going to take a quick break. Back with Open Line Reaction at 250-386-1161 after this.
If it's happening, it's here. This is Adam Sterling on CFAX 1070.
Generative AI. Semiconductor and graphics company, actually, NVIDIA, makes expensive cards for computers that most of us played games on once upon a time, is actually suddenly seeing massive increases in its market valuations because the chips that it makes are needed in the generative AI process that's suddenly becoming more and more popular. NVIDIA has an interesting write-up at NVIDIA.com on what is generative AI, and it says generative AI enables users to quickly generate new content based on a variety of inputs. Inputs and outputs to these models can include text, images, sounds, animation, 3D models, and other data. It talks about generative adversarial networks. It says they were discovered in 2014. They were considered to be the most commonly used methodology of the three that are present before the recent success of what they call diffusion models. They would pit two neural networks against each other. A generator would generate new samples, and a discriminator would learn to distinguish between the generated content as either real or fake. The diffusion, or the reverse diffusion process, is interesting. What it essentially does is use statistical algorithms to perform just a monster number of mathematical calculations to work backwards as to what is likely to be adjacent to, say, a pixel in a photograph or a word in a text document, and what is less likely to work backwards to generate the same search results as what you print into the text bar. So it's easy to train a computer to read some text and produce a synopsis of what's in it. What generative AI does is it does it backwards. You give it a synopsis, and it generates, based on statistical probability, output that would likely have that same synopsis created for it. It does the process backwards. And it really wows people because we're like, oh my God, you can press a button now and it creates a picture of a scene that's never existed and somebody that's never existed. What most of us don't realize is that it has to look at millions, if not billions, of pictures to actually get these statistical models built somewhere in a mainframe to be able to do that. So one of the curious phenomenon that we saw when these generative AI photos started going around the internet everywhere is one of the hallmarks that would tell you that it wasn't real is you'd look at the people's hands and they'd have like 10 fingers or like on each hand, I mean, or like 8 fingers or something weird like that. Their hands would be too long, or they'd have clubbed hands with no fingers at all. Their faces in many cases would look fine, but sometimes they'd have too many teeth and there'd be something kind of off. You'd be looking at it, wondering what it was. And it's because people's faces on the internet, there's like billions of pictures out there. So the machine, the more material that it's fed, the better it gets at reproducing it. It's just raw numbers. Whereas people's hands, apparently, there aren't that many pictures, comparatively speaking. So the artificial intelligence would know how to generate a face that would convince you and me as our brains to say that it's a true face. It's good enough. It's close enough of a facsimile. But the hands it wouldn't be able to get, or the teeth that it wouldn't be able to get. Those were on the older versions. Nowadays, you can generate Midjourney's one, and there's some others that you can get that will generate just completely photorealistic, completely convincing images that just never existed. They're just made up from nothing. The amount of calculations and processing power required to do that is beyond all decent contemplation. So you have a situation now where some of these scarce chips made by NVIDIA, made by others, are being bought up to the point where there's just no more available because companies are trying to get the edge on this. There is a useful phenomenon, though, that arises that I've been reading about. Because I have some texts here by saying, like, I'm scared of AI. Why don't we ask AI to solve homelessness and a crime wave in our community? Somebody else says, have you seen Megan? That's some scary stuff. AI freaks me out. AI can't be smarter than us, and it can't be smarter than what it's actually creating, because all it can do is approach that level of reality and reproducing and mimicry, but it can't build on it. There's a fascinating article, and I can't remember where I've got the URL. I should have put it up on Twitter before this segment. My apologies. It slipped my mind. Some of the experiments that computational researchers are doing right now with these generative AI models is they're training them not on real pictures off the internet, like the current generation were trained, and that's how they learned to produce these pictures in the first place. What happens if you use AI-generated content to train the AI? Like if I have a new AI with no training, and instead of having it crawl through the internet and look at a billion real pictures to learn how to make pictures, what if I feed it only made up pictures? What if I feed it only AI pictures? And there's a fascinating thing that happens. It drifts. The AI models that they train using only AI generated content, the pictures get less and less and less believable. See, this suggests that while it might be difficult for you and me to pick up, these AI generated photos are not actually 100% facsimiles. That while we might not notice them, there are artifacts within them. And what we're seeing when we train an AI with AI-generated content is a sort of drifting. It's like making a facsimile of a facsimile of a facsimile and a facsimile of a facsimile of a facsimile of a facsimile. It starts to drift. So these AI models we're now starting to learn require a constant infusion of real content to train them. And we can't generate content to train new ones because you can't have a fax of a fax without it losing something. And so now there's interesting questions about copyright, and the courts are likely going to be asked to decide on whether or not copyright was violated by an AI model that went through like a billion web pages and didn't credit any of them or something along those lines. And that's going to be really fascinating in terms of who owns this stuff. And I don't pretend to know how that's going to go. But I do find it really useful to sort of think about what these models actually are, what they can do, and remind ourselves that they're not good enough to operate without human input yet. Even though they can create what looks like human input to your eye and my eye, it's not. Because when we use the output that they create to train new AIs, it doesn't work. It actually loses its fidelity. It loses its resolution, suggesting that there is still an edge that the human being has that the machine cannot replicate. And I find that at least a little bit reassuring. I want to go to Brandon, who's calling in. Hey, Brandon, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Hey, Adam. AI is such a massive topic here in North America. So I work with the White Hatter. We are a team that teaches digital literacy in schools. Given back to school is happening, well, pretty soon, teachers, educators, and parents right now are having these conversations because not every educator is prepared for this new revolution of doing work. And there's a lot of conversation about grade school students, high school students, should they be using AI to do their homework assignments? And what tools do teachers have if they're going to allow that? Do they consider that cheating? These are huge questions that everyone's trying to deal with right now.
When we take a look at the possibilities here, we had a guest on earlier in the hour, but she teaches, of course, adults at Simon Fraser University's Beattie School of Business. Her method will be assuming that everybody's going to have access to these tools, so they're going to assume that instead of banning the tools or assuming that they're not used, they're going to simply raise the standards, so it's going to be assumed that you have an AI assistant helping you with writing. What do you make of that?
I actually agree with that, because if we're looking at a competitive market, if you are a business or a working professional and you're competition, and you're not, you could be at a competitive market. But when we're looking at schools, working professionals getting MA, they usually have the fundamental back understanding of what an essay looks like, proper grammar, spell checking. So at what level should AI be utilized in grade school? Because there's the idea of repetition. The more essays you write yourself in grade school, the better you should be able to comprehend and communicate in our society. So if a student is taking a work home assignment and they use AI, bring it to class, is that going to help them in the future, or is that going to be a detriment? And because we're in this world right now, we don't have a clear answer. There are paths that this could take, but it's a very interesting philosophical question in regards to at what level. See, the calculator, when that was first being introduced into grade school, there was huge pushback. People thought calculators should not be used. But today, students in high school are doing mathematical equations that was once only done at university level.
It is an interesting question to ask, you know, in terms of to what degree do we just want to incorporate these tools versus how much do we want to deprive our young people, our children, of these tools so that they learn the way things used to be done before these tools existed. And I find I can't really land on a uniform application of any rules that I like, because obviously in the real world, they're going to have a computer because everybody carries their phone around with them. So they're going to have a calculator. The old adage about, well, are you going to walk around with a calculator the rest of your life? Well, all of us do now. In terms of generative AI, I'm not really sure. I suppose that we should be training kids for the jobs of the future. The only problem is nobody knows what those are going to be.
Exactly. And AI just might replace those jobs altogether. So these are huge questions that no one really has a solid answer for. I think what I've heard from teachers locally and across Canada is if a teacher's doing a take-home work assignment, homework, and it can be easily answered by AI, perhaps the take-home assignment isn't best developed. Perhaps teachers and educators need to rework their assignments so that an AI model can't easily answer that question.
Hmm. Interesting
thoughts.
But
then again, kids are going to teach, we're going to cheat regardless. I mean, you know, they'll go on, find an excerpt on Napoleon and copy that into their essay, or borrow their older sibling's essay from years ago and reuse that. So if students are going to use AI to cheat, they'll use other tools to cheat anyway. So these are big questions. And I think these conversations for families listening, have that conversation with your kids and maybe be present when they're doing their take-home assignment and evaluate what your values are on what actual amount of work your student puts into their homework that you are okay with. Is AI okay?
Brandon Lauer with the White Hatter. Thanks for calling in. Call me anytime, okay?
No problem. Have a good day.
All right, you too. Have a good day. Yeah, it's interesting questions being raised. I suppose that this is
I never really thought about that. The ethical implications of generative AI with respect to schooling. Because the prose is generated using statistical tools, you can actually work backwards and generate a probability profile for whether or not the text that you're reading actually is generated by AI. But on the other hand, there is a non-zero possibility that a person can just choose to write that prose and happen to write it like an AI would, and they could be falsely implicated by those. I mean, it is theoretically possible for two people who have never read each other's work, never met each other, never interacted in any way to sit down and write exactly the same thing separated by space and time. It's not technically plagiarism, or is it, if two people come up with exactly the same thing when separate from one another? With AI, it's possible, although unlikely, but, you know, law of large numbers, make population big enough and somebody will have it happen to them, unlucky as they are, will get flagged as having produced AI copy. Copy is just a term we use in the news business for writing something. When in fact they didn't, they just happened to write it like the AI would. And the AI is trying to write it like a human would anyway. So the closer the AI gets to human writing, the more likely it is that would happen, right? I suppose it would vary depending on the length of the actual prose. You know, like a 3-word sentence be a lot more likely to be duplicated than a 5,000-word document. Anyway, quick break. Hour 4 coming up.